all these introductions, so we're ready to proceed with our first case this morning, which is 00-1836, Physicians Plus Insurance Corporation versus Midwest Mutual Insurance Company. And I have scheduled a series of lawyers, and we'll just read it all so that we make sure that we're in agreement. Mr. Anderson will have 7 minutes representing the Teresa Mutual Fire Insurance. Mr. Gross will have 3 minutes representing Don Frankie et al. Mr. Storm will have 10 minutes representing Wisconsin Mutual, Municipal Mutual Insurance Company, Dodge County et al. And then Mr. Eckert will have 5 minutes representing Rural Mutual Insurance Company and the Township of Ujla, etc. That's one side. That should total 25 minutes. And then Mr. Farnsworth, if you feel lonely at that side of the table, you get an entire 30 minutes. And Mr. Anderson, you're going to do rebuttal for 5. Are we in agreement? Okay. We'll start with you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. We've got an ambitious schedule on this side of the house, and I'm going to try and cut to the chase if I can. I represent Teresa Mutual Insurance Company, and along with Tom Goss, who represents the Frankies, we filed the brief. With the briefs, I think, outline the basic issues that we think require reversal by the Court of Appeals. This case is based not upon this tree blocking the road, but blocking a stop sign. That's the claim that's made in the complaint in this case. The only claim in the complaint is that this tree didn't block the view of any person on the road in and of itself. It blocked the stop sign. Our briefs outline the fact that we think that that's if there's going to be liability assessed for maintaining a tree, that's a liability that should be assessed by the legislature. We've outlined the cases in our briefs that indicate pretty clearly that the putting in of a sign and the maintenance of a sign is a non-delegable duty, and that it cannot be delegated to the public or to the landowner. We talk about the fact that there is no coextensive duty, as argued by the respondent, and we've also argued that there's no common law liability, and we've also argued that this is a very good public policy, but the Court of Appeals has done, and I've outlined all of that. In the brief time that I have today, I thought it would be best served to delve into the two cases that respondent relies upon most heavily, and that's the Brown and the Plessible cases, and to look at those cases and see what this court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, has done with those cases since Brown and Plessible. Brown and Plessible both involve rotten trees. They both involve trees that were in a median between the sidewalk and the curb. And the court in both those cases said that the landowner had an obligation with regard to those rotten trees, and those rotten trees fell on somebody. There were some ordinances involved in both of those cases, but I think the key is that both courts, both Brown and Plessible, said, look, if you've got this rotten tree over in the lot line, even if it's not in this boulevard, even when it's not in an area that's involved by these ordinances, that the landowner is going to have liability. And in a sense, liability is no more than if someone had walked under the tree. If a tree had been anywhere and someone walks underneath that tree and it falls on them, they've got liability. And both those cases indicated that we really don't have an involvement here of these ordinances. That this tree is if it off on the side, the liability to the landowner is still the same. We, on the other hand, have something that's completely different. This case is centered on the stop sign. Cases subsequent to Brown and Plessible, Pappas and the High case, all indicated that when you have a legislative obligation, when you have a sidewalk that's involved, when you have a street involved, when you've got the legislature that said, okay, put up the stop sign, and that you have an obligation once you decide to put up that stop sign to maintain it, we're not dealing with a municipal obligation, a public obligation. And when it comes smack dab into something that wasn't present in either Brown or Blessing. In the subsequent cases, Pappas and Crye, even though Justice Wilkie dissented in Crye, by the time Pappas and Janczak, the two cases that we cite, are handed down, there seem to be two pretty firm principles involved. Number one, there's no way that the Brown doesn't apply and Plessko doesn't apply if it involves repair and maintenance of a road or sidewalk, and if the matter is wholly within the control of the property owner, that's when they're going to apply. If the city's not involved in repair or maintenance, then the matter is wholly within the control of the property owner.
Say that again, that last sentence again.
Sure. If the road applies only if the repair or maintenance of a road or sidewalk is not involved. And number two, it was further within the control of the property owner.
Will this be a different case? Would the your argument be the same if this tree were located solely on the Franks property but not within the township right of way?
Yes.
Then you concede that the Franks are right of way?
No. Because if you move it up, if you move it into their property, and if you want to move it over and it's no longer blocking the sign, you know,
it would be
still blocking the sign. The principle is the same.
And the principle is the state principle.
The principle is that when you have a municipality that's erected a stop sign, and it's a stop sign that's the subject of the of this case, and the legislature, Dodge County, could not put up, if they didn't put up a stop sign, nobody could complain about it. That's a legislative decision. But once they make that legislative decision, the statutes and this ordinance said that the obligation is to, when they erect it, they've got a duty to erect and maintain it.
Could the county or town come in, regardless of whether the tree is in the right of way or the tree is totally on private property, under Justice Babbage's example, but it's overlapping that stop sign. Can the county cut those limits?
Yes. I can't give you a statute. But
can
I think
even
that they
have the property.
And it's blocking the stop sign.
It's trespassing. That tree is trespassing.
I think the legislature has indicated quite clearly in the statute they got an obligation to maintain it and give them the right to go in and do whatever they need to do. It can't be delegated.
Assuming that the nuisance analysis out the window for your client, I'll just assume that. Why is there not a cause of action on negligence, just ordinary negligence? Your client owes a duty of reasonable care, drove out the driveway every day, saw that the hazard, has the duty to exercise reasonable care.
No.
Why not?
Nothing wrong with the tree.
Pardon me?
There's nothing wrong with that tree.
And so if the tree is blocking, let's say if it is, for argument's sake, totally blocking, and they see that, and it's foreseeable that drivers will not see the stop sign because of that, it's your position that no duty of reasonable care.
I think you're in the same boat that you're in, Ralph's, that you're dealing with a natural condition of the land. That's what the landowner has control over. And it becomes no different between a stop sign and a sharp curb, a stop sign and an obstructed intersection. At least thus far, the court has indicated in Wells that back in 1945 that made good sense. I think you have it, and I'll sit down my time zone, but you have a blending, if you will, of duty and public policy. I'm never sure when one starts and the other leaves off.
Well, that's a question I have. How do you interpret the Court of Appeals decision?
What they did in this case.
Legal analysis. And how do you think the decision should be written by this court? And I'm going to ask that of the counsel.
I think the decision should be written that the legislative obligation of stop signs rests with the legislature, and it's non-delegable. And the best example I can see of that in these cases is of all things, of Chart versus Devorah, which is a state case. And Dodge County, for example, is saying they, once they put the tree, put this sign up, everybody else had an obligation to do it. You look at Chart, and it's interesting because the state, that was a state case, a state highway, and they had the municipal, they had, I think, the district supervisor and the district engineer were the two defendants. And they came into court and they said, well, you can't sue us because, well, although we decided to put up a stop, warning sign about a sharp curve ahead. We're not obligated. You got the wrong people. We didn't put out, we didn't measure it. And we didn't decide where it was going to go. And this court indicated, and the court said no. That obligation is your obligation. You're carrying out the obligation of the state. That obligation is non-delegable. You may let someone else go out and do that planting of the sign for you, but you couldn't delegate that obligation. And the same thing is true with the stop sign. Dodge County can go out and they can put it up, but they can't say, gee, it's somebody else's obligation to take care of our sign for us. That isn't any more delegable than it was for the folks in Chart versus Dvorak to tell them to say, well, gee, it's not our fault. The employees put it in the wrong place. Both were non-delegable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Goss.
I'm Tom Goss. I have the privilege of representing the defendants, Donald and Hermelda Frithagain, and Donner Farms. I'm going to be addressing very, very briefly the summary judgment aspects of the Court of Appeals opinion. In short, we believe there are issues of fact, material issues of fact, which would warrant submission of these issues to the jury, be it nuisance, be it negligence, because under Brusco, I don't think it makes any difference, the proof is the same, and that these determinations cannot be made as a matter of law. And there are basically two factors here. Number one, what was the extent of the obstruction to the stop sign by the tree branch? There's no question that there was an obstruction. There is an issue of fact, I believe, as to the extent of the obstruction. And photographs alone do not change that determination as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals in that regard relied on the Chart case, and there in Chart, I think the facts were different. The analysis was made, the accident happened at night. The plaintiff's analysis was made during the daytime, and the court said very simply it had no bearing at all. I would refer this court to the jury instruction on physical facts found at 325 that basically indicates that where there's a conflict between physical facts and testimony, that the jury has to reconcile that, and that the district disregard the testimony only if beyond reasonable doubt cannot be reconciled. So again, I don't think it's fair for the Court of Appeals to make that determination as a matter of law. The other issue was with regard to assuming there is an accident there, and again, still under the same rubric, whether we're talking about negligence or nuisance, did the landowner, the Broncos in this case, assuming they have a duty, have notice of the problem. And here, I don't think there's any dispute that the Broncos did not have actual notice, although there was some hint of that in the Court of Appeals opinion. We take exception to that. But basically, the court focused on whether they had constructive notice. And constructive notice, again, typically is an issue for the jury to address. What's reasonable under the circumstances? And here, what we have is we have a private landowner who's been told, you have to maintain this stop sign. Question is, what would a reasonable property owner think under the circumstances? The Frankies live at this residence for a long period of time. They're well aware of the intersection. Most importantly, they're well aware of the existence of the stop sign. So they're not going to be a reasonable juror that could say, hey, they don't need to look at that stop sign when they're using Ledge Road and County Highway Z because they know it's there. They know it's there.
But your objection to the Court of Appeals, and I gather you would join Mr. Anderson.
Yes, I do.
But your objection is that trial should not be limited to causation and damages, that it should include, if you don't win on the grounds, Mr. Anderson said, well, should include
the defenses
and negligence.
Absolutely. and these are questions of fact for the jury to answer. And again, with regard to the notice, whether they had constructive notice, the Court of Appeals, based on the arborist's affidavit, indicated, well, there was at least 2 to 3 months where there was foliage there. But the arborist's affidavit doesn't tell us the extent of the obstruction during that 2 to 3 months. The arborist tells us this, is, this honey locust tree is a medium to fast-growing tree, whatever that is. And just and for that reason alone, there are issues of fact for the jury to pass them on and for cross-examination. It's also opinion testimony as well. And the case law, I think, is very clear that opinion testimony cannot be offered in the summary judgment setting. It's only evidentiary facts.
May I ask a question, Justice? You started with advancing that it makes no difference if there is a nuisance analysis or negligence analysis under Plesko, it remains the same. However, Mr. Arneson, I think, at least on behalf of whoever wrote on behalf of the homeowners, indicates at page 27 of his brief that the Court of Appeals holding that nuisance liability can be imposed upon crankies without any showing of negligence was, in effect, the imposition of absolute liability, which is contrary to all Wisconsin precedent. I read that argument as saying, hey, it does make a difference to the crankies because if you go the route of nuisance, there's it's tantamount to absolute liability, and that is contrary to Wisconsin law. How do you respond to that in view of your initial statement that makes no difference vis-a-vis the Frankies?
I don't believe that nuisance law applies for justice, but I'm saying that even if the court, from the standpoint of my topic of summary judgment, that the proof is the same because of nuisance. There are three variants. There's either ultra-hazardous activity, intentional conduct, or negligent. We don't have ultra-hazardous here. We don't have intent. The only thing that's left would be negligent. And as this court has described in the past, the whole concept of nuisance is a slippery concept.
Do you think the Court of Appeals was wrong engaging in a nuisance analysis and said that we thus recognize that under our analysis, the liability of the defendants is predicated on their failure to eliminate a nuisance and not on any negligent act or omission on their part. Is that incorrect?
I think it's clearly incorrect.
Thank you, Mr. Goss.
Thank you very much.
Attorney Robert Stahl.
Bob Stark. I represent Dodge County, their employees, Robert Emberton, Robert Hankin, and their insurer, Wisconsin Municipal Mutual Insurance Company. Dodge County should not be found to be a party to a nuisance as a matter of law, in this case for a number of reasons. First, it's undisputed that the branches which caused the problem were on a tree located on land owned by the Frankies and within the town of Leroy and Ledge Road right-of-way. The undisputed survey map and the undisputed affidavits of the highway engineer and Dodge County Highway Commissioner established that Dodge County had no duty of maintenance on Ledge Road where the affected tree was located. Dodge County is not the owner or the public authority responsible for this tree and had no control over it. In the early morning hours of the day following the accident, which happened in the late afternoon, Don Leroy, board member, and Mr. Frankie removed the branch, offending branches, making the stop sign perfectly level. This clearly established that the tree branches themselves were the problem. And Dodge County had no control over those tree branches, but the control was in Frankie's and the town Leroy. Number three, according to Center 2nd, page 858, Highway Streets and Bridges, quote, where a tree or part of a tree renders or is reasonably likely to render public travel on a highway unsafe, the responsible public authority has a duty to trim or remove such tree. Dodge County is not the responsible public authority, and therefore I have no duty to trim such tree. The one Wisconsin case, Brown, involved a tree found to be nuisance. In this instance, the tree was rotted and in poor condition. It was held to be a nuisance because it was unsafe and dangerous for the users of the street, sideway, and area in between. In the Brown case, the city of Milwaukee was a public authority who had governing rules regarding streets and sidewalks, and the city of Milwaukee was originally found to be the sole cause of that nuisance.
Mr. Hearing, Mr. Sore, let me interrupt you if I might. Did the county place the stop sign?
The county put up the stop sign.
Does the county have any responsibility to be sure that that stop sign is observable, that it's something that people can see and recognize?
Well, there is a rule, which is in the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which says that special attention and necessary action should be taken to see that weeds, trees, shrubbery, and construction materials do not obscure the face of any sign. But this manual does not require inspection to make the sign visible. Dodge County did have a procedure if they had actual knowledge of an obstruction to contact the owner of the town Leroy to remove the obstructing branches. There's a statute, Wisconsin Statute 86034, which prohibits Dodge County from trimming the branches of the tree located in the town Leroy right-of-way owned by Frankies. The statute says that the only parties who can trim that tree are the owner of the land or the public authority maintaining the highway.
Now, I understand that the county, on a somewhat annual basis, does an inspection of stop signs. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But my understanding is they do it at the time of year when there are no leaves on the trees.
That is correct. They do it at night because they're trying to find out the reflection possibilities of the stop sign to make sure it was able to be seen and was in good condition. That is the truth. They only do that once a year. And it's our position that we had a duty to see that the stop sign itself was in good condition, but not to go out and check the visibility. And, of course, there is a general rule that no person can be held liable for a nuisance he cannot physically abate. And I'm citing 58 AM Juris 2nd, 781. Dodge County could not physically abate this nuisance, which we say is caused by the branches in the tree, and not by the stop sign. The stop sign was in perfect condition. Even the plaintiff, in its brief on page 35, indicates here there is no question of keeping a straight highway or sign defect in need of repair. It is undisputed that the sign itself, both in placement and condition, were in proper repair.
Well, you've stated that you recognize the county, once it erects a sign, has a duty to maintain, and you emphasize maintain, the sign.
The sign itself, that's correct.
So if the sign were knocked down, it was knocked down rather, the county would have a duty to place it, erect.
Erect, replace it, and that's the Necker case said that there was 19 days and they didn't do a thing and therefore they were really a nuisance.
If the sign were defaced by a bunch of high school kids that were riding around one night and took some spray paint and don't try this at home, by the way, kids, and sprayed the sign so you couldn't breathe. enough notice, the county would have a duty to do something about that.
Yes, they would, otherwise they'd be negligent.
And if the same high school kids went and said, oh, what we're going to do is right in front of that stop sign, we're going to erect this wooden 4x6 thing, just to get them, and put it right in front of the stop sign, 3 inches in front of the stop sign, and they did that, and we were naughty. With the intent to obscure the sign, you say the county has no obligation.
No, I don't say they have no obligation. And they did have a procedure where if they knew about anything, they would have to contact Frankie and Don Leroy to take care of it.
What's the difference between a bunch of teenagers going and erecting a 4x6 or 3 inches in front of the stop sign and trees that are 3 inches in front of limbs that are 3 inches in front of the stop sign and obscure the view?
First of all, the tree wasn't 3 inches from the stop sign.
My hypothetical is 3 inches.
And the highway itself would make them responsible for anything with a sign in the highway sign, which was the public authority to take care of that particular property. But that didn't extend to the tree, which is, I think, 35 or 40 feet from the stop sign.
Now, Mr. Stark,
yes.
Why did the county conduct its inspections in November?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One of them is there are more people not doing much work at that time, so they do it at that time. Now, if you would have to do it 4 or 5 times a summer while trees are growing and so forth, that becomes an impossible task. And I want to talk about, is that an answer to your question?
But you're saying that the county made, they weren't required by law or anything to conduct the inspection in November.
No, they were not.
So they made the decision.
They made that decision. But in November, if it was during the day or the night, there wouldn't have been these branches or leaves in the branches there. And the leaves in the branches were there how long? It added an inspection at that particular time, and it could be any time, and that's what I'm getting to is the Walker versus McDowell case.
They were concerned that the sign was reflecting properly.
Right. And that was a good condition, standing up and so forth. But they didn't have a duty to inspect to see whether any branches were going to be on this tree blocking the view.
How was it reflecting in late July?
What was that?
How was the sign reflecting in late July?
It was reflecting fine. The pictures show that it was in good condition. Even the plaintiff admits that it was in good condition. Okay. I want to talk a few minutes about Walker versus McNeil. This court in that case held that municipalities have no duty to cut or trim vegetation at highway intersections. Now, while both Smith claims Dodge County is attempting to extend this public policy announcement to cover the situation, that's not true. Dodge County had no duty to cut or trim vegetation at intersections, and then they would not have a duty to inspect, and certainly not one that made them a nuisance, party to a nuisance as a matter of law. The question is whether or not the rationale for that public policy covers our prison situation. We feel it does. The rationale meets squarely the facts in our present litigation. The rationale which was utilized to set up this policy says it would place an unreasonable and unmanageable burden upon municipalities keeping areas adjacent to every highway clear of the visual instructions. Dodge County has more than 1,000 stop signs, and other counties have many, many stop signs. And it would take 4 or 5 inspections during a growing period to determine whether these branches block visibility. And it would vary in each locality according to the rain, sun, and type of plant that's involved. The rationale said potential for significant financial liability owing to the unfortunate propensity of motorists having intersection accidents would become a factor in nearly every intersection accident case. Yesterday, I faxed a very recent Court of Appeals case in the state of Wagner. I assume you all got a copy of that.
Yeah, it was distributed to the court. You'll have to wind up your argument, Mr. Stone.
Okay. I just want to say that I agree with the Wagner case, which says they will not step in and create a liability in light of the potential costs. The last sentence in their majority opinion, and they say, because the Supreme Court is the only one that can be have the authority to make a change in the policy. They say they said you cannot abrogate against liability, and I agree with that. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin has that ability, and the lower courts do not. We think that the Walker policy is a good and necessary policy and ask that it be affirmed in this lawsuit and leave Dodge County out of the case. Thank you.
I do have one final question on that recent case, the Court of Appeals case that you said. Is that a controlled or an uncontrolled intersection?
What was that?
Was that an accident at a controlled or uncontrolled intersection? Does that make any difference to the analysis?
I really don't know. Sorry.
Well, we can check that in the briefs of the case. Mr. Eckert?
Thank you. My name is Phil Eckert. I represent the town of Leroy, its officials, and its insurer, Rural Mutual. I disagree with the county's analysis of the situation. I think the statutes, which are quoted in my brief, are clear that the maintenance of that stop sign is clearly placed with the county. Case law indicates that involved in the maintenance of a stop sign is not just the situation of making sure the stop sign is reflective, it's that the stop sign is free from obstructions, trees, etc., so that the traveling public can observe that stop sign for their safety. That's the purpose of putting the stop sign up there anyways. The scheme of requiring the county to place and maintain the stop sign has been clearly established by the legislature. The Court of Appeals, in order to find a responsibility, if you will, on the part of the county, or a town, excuse me, looks at Section 8101 and 8105 of the statutes and says that those two statutes read together indicate public policies which do two things, which one, oblige or obligate the town to maintain its roads. 8115 clearly states that they must maintain the traveled portion of the road. The Court of Appeals acknowledged that this statute only applies to that. Then the Court of Appeals went on and said, but those two statutes empower the town to remove vegetation if the vegetation impedes safe travel. Therefore, they find a public create a public policy duty saying the town now has a co-duty with that the town has a co-duty with the town, with the county. The town and the county have a co-duty to remove that vegetation. If this is the case, then how is the primary responsibility, so the public really is to be protected, to be assigned? Does it mean that if the county doesn't do it, the town must do it? If the county does it, not to the town's liking, it must go out and second guess the county? The legislature, in establishing an absolute obligation on the part of the county, was trying to avoid these very questions. They're telling the county, you place the sign, you keep that sign clear for purposes of safety for the people riding on that highway. We're not going to make a dual responsibility so that the county and the town get into arguments or have to establish procedures. The Court of Appeals is right in order to protect the public. My opinion, the town and the county would have to enter into some sort of 660301 agreement saying, okay, you take care of this stop sign, we'll take care of that stop sign, to make sure that the public is protected otherwise.
Mr. Eckert, if I might interrupt for a minute. There are a couple of things that I don't clearly understand. This tree was in the town's right-of-way, was it not?
No, I don't believe so. The branches from the tree were hanging over the town right-of-way. That's what the trial court found.
Okay. And my understanding of the facts given to the trial court and the Court of Appeals would indicate that the tree had been trimmed prior to the accident on one side, on the side facing the Frankies, but not on the side toward the roadway. Is that your understanding of the facts?
No, I believe the court found or mentioned in the trial court that the branches overhanging the stop sign were cleared right after the accident, cut right after
right,
the accident.
But before the accident, is that correct that the tree had been trimmed on one side, the side facing the Frankies, but not on the side facing the roadway?
It might have been by the Frankies, not by the town.
Okay, the town had nothing to do with the trimming.
Correct. The town never touched that tree in any manner.
And the facts would indicate who had trimmed the tree as far as the side facing the Frankies.
I believe so.
Sorry to interrupt you, but Appendix 104, which is the Court of Appeals decision, it says, and I don't know that it matters, but it says the tree was located on land owned by the Frankies. We all agree on that. And its trunk was either wholly or in large part within the town's right-of-way.
That's one point. You'll find another point in the appendix. The trial court did say it wasn't making a definite finding exactly where the trunk was, but it was absolutely clear that the branches from the tree were in the town right-of-way. They were hanging over the town right-of-way.
Think of that as any, it makes any difference where the trunk is?
No.
No. Just so that's really an irrelevant
I don't,
issue.
Correct.
The branches were hanging over the town's right-of-way and the stop sign.
Correct.
Okay.
In my opinion, the location of the tree makes no difference. It's the branches from that tree that create the problem with respect to the safety of the stop sign. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Eckert, everybody here says he or she or it is not liable. So is this a case where somebody's been damaged, which can happen. I mean, just because somebody's been injured doesn't mean somebody else has to pay. But you say the township is not liable.
Yes, I.
And Mr. Stork says the county is not liable.
I disagree with Mr. Stork. I believe the county is liable in this case.
and the Frankies and their insurance company say they're not liable. What do you say about that? Do you have an opinion?
I did not address that in my brief, Justice.
You don't have to. Your job here is to see that your client's not liable.
I specifically avoided that question.
Okay.
And why is that?
All right, Mr. Eckert, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Farnsworth, representing the injured party, Timothy Smith. Everybody has had a little extra time, so you'll get some too, but you don't have to feel obliged to take it.
I do not feel obliged to use it all. I am Eric Farnsworth. I do represent Tim Smith, now the estate of Tim Smith. I stand in proximity to an enlargement of the photographic evidence relied on by the trial court and the Court of Appeals. To most observers, this is not an appropriate case to be proposing or extension of immunities to those responsible for this hazard. The trial court and the Court of Appeals were correct in finding that no reasonable jury properly instructed on the law of nuisance could conclude that this obstruction was not a hazardous interference with safe travel, onerous, and public privacy. This was not new law. This was not an extension of existing law. This was common sense. And the trial court was not given any material facts to create a genuine issue. But that is a public nuisance.
Farnsworth, if I may, just for identification purposes, you have the date that the bond photograph was taken.
Only in reference to the accident, it was well after the accident.
And the July 21st of 96, that's
the date of the accident.
Date of the accident.
Approximately 1.5 to 2 hours after the actual accident. The top photograph comes from the
video. Let me just interrupt you for a minute. Would the marshal just turn then? Oh, you circulate. As long as everybody has it. If not, you can just turn it so everybody can see the picture, photographs. We all have individual copies. Charlie, yes, please. Then the top one was taken in relatively short time after the accident. The bottom one was taken a long time after the accident.
The photograph, Your Honor, is a still frame from the videotape taken by the Sheriff's Department as he walked the path that the auto driver, Smith, would have been taking as she approached this intersection.
Counsel, in your opening comments, mentioned the word immunity, just for clarification, because when I was reading some of the arguments advanced, I thought about other cases that would have approached this set of facts with immunity in mind. I understand. Tell me if I'm correct. My recollection, that we don't have any issue of immunity before us, that immunity may have been raised, but it was deemed the trial court wasn't going to allow an amendment to raise immunity, and the Court of Appeals agreed. So we do not have the issue of immunity before us.
You do.
We do.
You
okay.
Do. The immunity issue you were referring to was the county who attempted to belatedly raise the immunity of discretionary immunity but failed to plead it.
Governmental immunity.
Governmental immunity. The immunity that's before you, because of your questioning, you immediately got to the point with the attorney for the homeowner when you said, why isn't the general duty of due care, which all citizens have according to this court, at minimum applicable here? And the answer was immunity for either natural conditions or rural trees or homeowners that are only passively negligent, all those concepts attempt to come from an immunity at the turn of the century, which they tried to resurrect out of the restatement section 363. That, in essence, is what the homeowner is asking for.
So it's a kind of non-negligence concept we're talking about, or
immunity to both.
Of public policy, but we're not talking about governmental immunity.
Correct. Okay. So that issue is before the court, and in light of this undisputed factual evidence, it seems a particularly inappropriate case to be asking for it. Let's see what cannot be seriously disputed.
Mr. Farnsworth, before you leave immunity, has restatement of torts, section 363, ever been adopted by this court?
I'm glad you asked. My position is that it has not. The only basis for claiming that it has is the cite to the Court of Appeals decision in Wells. However, the Court of Appeals decision in Wells was accepted on petition by this court, and this court's decision specifically said, while we affirm the Court of Appeals decision, we do so on the grounds that we have analyzed. And they were not, expressly in your decision you stated, they are not addressing the common law liability of due care, but rather we're restricting our decision to whether or not the 1889 statute for clearing railroad crossings in itself created civil liability. And on that narrow ground, where this court looked to the legislative intent that must have existed more than 100 years ago, it said we cannot find a private civil cause of action generated from that statute. We do not address whether or not those obstructions could constitute a violation of common law duties of care. That's what this court said. It did not predicate its decision on 363. I'd like to address, because that is the nub of the homeowner's defense. They can't withstand summary judgment if you look at any duty of due care, because they admitted they did nothing in the face of an obstruction. Was it partial? Was it complete? The homeowner says, well, if you know the signs there, you can see some of it. A lot of good that did to Mrs. Smith, who was sightseeing at the Horicon March. There's no dispute of material fact. The problem here is that the defendants were content below to rely on their legal defenses. And the record they created to resist summary judgment did not create any genuine issues of material fact. The fact that a significant...
existed, whether 99% or 89% or 100%, could not be disputed and wasn't disputed here today. And hence, no one can say this didn't constitute a public nuisance, whether 80% or 100%.
What kind of public nuisance are you talking about? If it's a public nuisance...
The definitions which we provided in the brief is any hazard which incommodes or renders dangerous the free travel of the public on a highway or in proximity to that highway constitutes a public nuisance.
Darth, as I understand it, could be wrong, there are three approaches, and one of your opposing counsel noted those. Public nuisance with regard to ultra-hazardous activity, oftentimes we think of dynamite, chemicals, that kind of thing. Intentional nuisance and negligent nuisance. What's the if nuisance is the proper analysis for this case, which of those three is the proper subset of the analysis?
Obviously the final, but I would like to address that point because there has been much talk in this case whether the failure to abate this obvious hazard constituted negligence or nuisance. And I suggest, Justice Bradley, that we are literally chasing our linguistic tails by attempting to say that they are mutually exclusive concepts. No one could seriously dispute that a near total obstruction to a life-saving stop sign bordering an arterial highway with vehicular traffic at 55 miles an hour did not constitute a nuisance or a hazard to the traveling public. The fact that this constituted a significant obstruction also couldn't be disputed. But to be liable for it, you have to have a duty, you can't be immune, and you have to have either actual or constructive notice of the nuisance. Enter traditional negligence concepts. That's what the third aspect of nuisance is about. So when they say the Court of Appeals imposed strict liability by using a nuisance concept, they misquote the Court of Appeals decision. In fact, if you look at the page that you just cited from Justice Bradley, the Court of Appeals said, in determining whether a nuisance exists in the first instance, whether people exercise due care prior to its creation is technically irrelevant. The fact that it exists is determined by the facts presented. Did it constitute an unreasonable hazard to the traveling public? Once it's determined to exist, then traditional concepts of negligence did come into play in both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Strict liability was not imposed here. Look at a strict liability case. A product is found unreasonably dangerous. All those in the distributive scheme are liable. It doesn't matter if they had notice, actual or constructive. If it was unreasonably dangerous, they're liable. That's strict liability. Once a nuisance is found, you still had to, and the courts below, apply traditional negligence concepts to find notice, either actual or constructive. It is not strict liability.
A couple of things I'm a little confused on. First of all, the homeowner argues not with regard to strict liability, but with regard to absolute liability, and those are different concepts. How do you respond to the homeowner's assertion on page 27, the Court of Appeals holding that nuisance liability can be imposed upon Frankie's without any showing of negligence was, in effect, the imposition of absolute liability?
That's what I was attempting to respond to, and maybe inartfully. That is an incorrect statement because the Court of Appeals imposed liability after doing two things, not one. One, finding as a matter of law that that constituted a public nuisance as a matter of law, undisputable. Number two, that as a matter of law, the Frankies had either actual or constructive notice of it and admittedly did nothing. That's not absolute liability. Absolute liability would be if this was in the back 40 and one of many trees countenanced by the restatement when they talk about rural trees, one of the many trees in the back 40 sitting next to a stream, and a fisherman is out there fly fishing and one of the trees falls over because it was rotted or because its branches were pulled on, that concept, if liability were imposed, would be absolute strict liability. That's not what occurred here. That's not what the Court of Appeals did. What I am saying to this court is that in this case, the defendants had an opportunity to try to rebut or to try to resist or controvert either the fact that this was a public nuisance or the extent of obstruction, and they did neither. They admitted that they did nothing to either try to catch this nuisance or to abate it. That made this context, those defenses, that factual record made this case particularly appropriate for summary judgment because of the convergence of those three facts.
Those three facts, again, are just 1, 2, 3 are what?
The three facts are these. The fact that they did not or could not dispute that this was a substantial, if not complete, obstruction to a life-saving stop sign on an arterial highway. The second fact, that such an obstruction under the law, as a matter of law, constitutes a public nuisance. None of you as a trial judge would have allowed a jury to come back and say, with this evidence, that's not a public nuisance. It doesn't unnecessarily incommode or render hazardous travel on an arterial highway. You wouldn't let such a verdict stand. That's number two. Number three, none of them attempted to show any exercise of reasonable care. The county and the town admitted, what we do will not catch this problem. We do it at a time or with an intent that by definition it won't catch this. The homeowner said, well, I thought it was partial, I didn't think it was complete, but did your wife, who is the land use surveyor for the town who attends all its meetings, say or call anybody? No. Did you say or call anybody? No. Did you exercise dominion over this tree? Yeah, I cut underneath in the side when it got in my way for mowing. Did you drive by it on your tractor twice a day? Yes. Could you have reached out the window of your tractor and snipped this branch off? Yes. Did you do anything? No. So there was no factual record of a material dispute. It was a clean legal issue and particularly appropriate for summary judgment.
Can I ask you, sir, there were people who lived across the ledge road, and I believe that was a town board member.
Linus Schroffnagler.
And that person probably drove that road many times as well. Should that person be liable too?
No, no one suggested that because it wasn't his tree, Justice Prosser. The Court of Appeals did suggest or make mention of that fact, but I am presuming because of the fact that the town is a defendant and the town officer lived very close to this hazard. And I think that discussion occurred during the actual constructive notice analysis. But no, there would be no basis. The sky will fall arguments that anybody driving this street, for instance, if Mrs. Smith happened to catch a glimpse of one of the letters, like Mr. Franke says you could do if the light was right and the wind was blowing and et cetera, that she would be liable if she saw it and didn't get on her cell phone and call the county. I mean, I think those are absurd arguments that don't bear on the fact that this undisputedly was the Franke's tree over which they exercised dominion. They trimmed it.
Why does it make any difference that they exercise dominion or don't exercise dominion? Don't the neighbors across the street, hypothetically, who drive past this number one obstruction, number two that was a public nuisance, why don't those neighbors, number three, have a right to exercise reasonable care to everyone in the world, including the plaintiffs here?
I think if you're a creative plaintiff's lawyer and you want to take that flyer, you might get yourself in front of a jury. I doubt it. But no jury is going to find reasonable care requires a neighbor who doesn't own the tree to step forward as a good Samaritan and make notice of a defect of somebody else's tree.
The point that you make and you used in your comments is exercise dominion over. What's your legal citation for that being an element?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals indicated when the homeowner was citing Brown and saying, unless you have absolute control over the hazard, you can't be liable. Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, nobody here is claiming that the Frankies lack control over this tree. In fact, they exercised dominion over it when they trimmed it to suit their convenience. So they were using it to rebut a defense, which was, we had no control, therefore Brown doesn't control.
Mr. Farnsworth, you're supporting the Court of Appeals' ultimate decision of liability here with a trial on causation, right?
Well, in my brief, I suggested that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in requiring a trial on causation relative to these three defendants because, in my opinion, in our opinion, no reasonable jury properly instructed on causation, which is it need only be a substantial factor, could return a verdict saying that this was not at least a substantial factor. In order to do that, they would have to say that the driver, Smith, who admittedly came off as not the most attentive driver in the world in her deposition, would not have seen the stop sign despite what we see in the picture of the bottom. She was so inattentive that she wouldn't have seen that. And that, in our judgment, is classic speculation to say the sign which is meant to focus drivers' attention on an intersection, even if it was there, would not have focused this driver's attention because, why? She didn't see the stop ahead sign 500 yards up the road, or at least didn't recall seeing a stop ahead sign after the trauma of this accident. So we took issue with that. Mr. Anderson is correct that we did not cross petition. But I would cite this court to its prior decisions, which indicate that once a case comes before this court, we, the court speaking, have discretion to review any substantial and compelling issue the case presents.
So it's not a matter of right, but discretion.
That's correct.
That issue.
And given the minutia of the facts that you are into already, given that we are arguing relative duties to abate and the hazard, it seemed to me with this undisputed factual record, why shouldn't cause be addressed by this court? But I recognize I did not cross-petition on it.
Mr. Farnsworth, what did you think of the Court of Appeals recommendation in regard to comparison, their suggestion that this be treated for comparison purposes like a products case?
Well, we made that suggestion to the trial court, and so we obviously agreed with the Court of Appeals. Two things. It makes no sense in the same way that you said that the Court of Appeals said, in determining if this constitutes a public nuisance, we are not looking at who exercised what care. We're looking at the factual record. It's irrelevant whether due care or lack of due care originally created it. We have a public nuisance. It makes no sense, then, to compare the conduct of drivers who then encounter the nuisance to the conduct of people who perhaps let the nuisance exist because they are two shades of a different tort. Just like product liability, it makes no sense to compare the conduct of somebody encountering a dangerous product to all the various actors in the distributive chain. You compare that conduct to the product itself. You then could have a subsequent comparison, as they do in product liability, for purposes of contribution. But it makes eminent sense to do it that way.
Has that been done in any other context other than products liability and perhaps successive torts?
I think successive torts, I think joint ventures where parties were engaged in a joint venture, whether it's drag racing or something else, there has been a determination that the act itself of the joint ventures needs to then be compared to what happened as a result of the joint venture. But the closest analogy is products liability, because the focus is the product, the focus is the hazard. It makes no sense to do individual comparisons. Once you agree, if you agree, that the determination of a public nuisance does not depend on the standard of care existing before the nuisance came into being, but what was the reaction to that nuisance in terms of attempting to abate it?
But if you do that sort of comparison, aren't you, in effect, imposing strict liability, which you have denied that this does?
No, because you don't even get to the jury verdict in the comparison unless first the court had found as a matter of law that under traditional negligence concepts there was actual or constructive notice of the hazard.
Then the second comparison question as between the defendants comes into play for contribution rights.
Correct.
Only.
Correct.
And the comparative negligence statute does not apply.
The what?
The comparative negligence statute therefore does not apply the new rules.
To the second comparison. It would in the first comparison you'd have the public nuisance. You would have Mrs. Smith who was encountering what you see at the top of that board. And if anybody had any evidence that plaintiff deceased Tim Smith driving down the public highway was negligent, then his name would be put on. And the driver's negligence in creating the accident would be compared to the nuisance itself.
If we were to open up this as the sort of case to take the new rules of comparative negligence or the new rules of joint and several liability where a plaintiff's negligence is compared against defendant's negligence individually, the percentages, doesn't that just open up the whole Pandora's box?
No, it doesn't.
And runs around those new rules?
No, it doesn't, because two reasons. One, the statute that you're afraid of being undermined expressly already has an exception in it, which is if you can demonstrate concert of action between one or more defendants, these comparison rules don't apply. So you've already got, but not you, the legislature already has in the statute the concept that if joint or concerted action produces an injury, we may not have individual comparison with those joint or concerted actors. So I don't think that we are opening a box that doesn't already exist in the statute itself. I'd like to, Justice Bradley said something about let's take nuisance out of the picture. It's easy to do because we don't see it much. We lawyers and you judges probably, it sounds like you're struggling with this concept, like what is it? I don't hear it that often. But if I could just give you a quick recitation, this court has consistently confirmed the vibrancy of the concept of nuisance when judging particular conduct or dangerous conditions several times. In Pry versus Moretti, Justice Abramson, you for the majority, rejected rigid rules that would immunize unbridled development of land in favor of a modern approach which used private nuisance law to balance the right of access to sunlight versus those who would obstruct it. again in Vogel, Justice Bradley, you writing for the court, refused to limit the doctrine of private nuisance in a stray voltage case, holding that older Wisconsin cases did not require that the concept be limited to an invasion of property interests which were unilateral or non-consensual. Lastly, if you look historically at this court's approach to requests for immunity in situations like this, you will see that this court has traditionally taken the approach that we do not favor rigid, inflexible rules of immunity. Rather, in the cases from Holitz that abrogated municipal immunity and said liability is the rule, immunity is the exception. From there, in Prah, Justice Abramson, you declined to recognize unfettered immunity to develop one's property, all the way to the Antonowitz, where this court said immunities are abolished based on the status of those entering property. We are adopting the standard of reasonable care under the circumstances for all persons, and the status of the person happens to be one of the circumstances that can be considered. You have demonstrated consistently that the modern trend is to evaluate the conduct or lack thereof based on its danger to society and standards of reasonableness, not inflexible rules of immunity. Go ahead.
Counsel, thank you. Let me return to follow up on Justice Sykes' line of questioning. Are you indicating that if you pursue a nuisance theory, that there is strict liability once you find a nuisance and notice of it?
No, I don't think the word strict has any application there any more than I would say, once you find duty and breach, you're liable, and darn it, strictly liable. I mean, once you find public nuisance and you find that there is no immunity based on old concepts of rural or natural conditions.
Once you find public nuisance, what?
And you find either actual or constructive notice of it, you are liable in the same way if you breach your general duty of due care. That's not strict. That's not absolute.
Well, see,
that's a breach of a duty.
You may be not using the term, but the way that you're approaching it is just like products liability, I think. And indeed, that's what the jury verdict is, you're advancing, set out for. You know, you're saying once you find a public nuisance, once you find a nuisance, and what's the second element?
Actual or constructive notice.
Okay, then there's liability.
I mean,
if you're talking about products liability, all you have to find that there was a product that was unreasonably dangerous when it left the place, that it caused. You don't need to show any negligence at all. There's strict liability after you show, I guess, the four elements or whatever it is, and products liability. That's what you seem to be saying here,
no,
except you only have two elements.
No, you're forgetting that in strict liability, Justice Bradley, what you say is correct, that once you find an unreasonably dangerous product, it didn't matter if the distributor knew it was unreasonably dangerous. It didn't matter even if the manufacturer appreciated it was unreasonable. It didn't matter if they took any actions towards recalling or reasonable care. We as a society said, you put an unreasonably dangerous product into the stream of commerce, you're liable. In this case, if we had simply said, hey, there's a public nuisance, we don't care how long it existed, we don't care where it was located, we don't care if it's your tree, we don't care if you had notice or not, yeah, that would be strict liability.
No,
but that's
you're
not
saying
what either
there's
court
a public,
did.
You're saying if there's a public nuisance and you have notice, then it's there's automatic liability, right?
Absent being immune, you have to either the connection to this case is undisputed. The sign undisputedly is the county's. The right-of-way is undisputedly the town. The tree is undisputedly the homeowner's. This is not in a vacuum that strict liability is being imposed.
I would like to close by alerting the court that the Restatement 363 that's being relied on is not what it appears to be. The American Law Institute in 1977, in Section 840, undermined Section 363 and said, wait a minute, in the intervening years based on the cases, we do find a duty of due care on property owners, even for natural conditions abutting public highways that pose a hazard. And the case law supports that. Lastly, calling this tree a natural condition is not supported under the restatement. Restatement says natural conditions are those that are not touched by human hand and grow in the wild. This tree had been topped, you will see in Mr. Franke's deposition, every 2 to 3 years by the utility that was protecting its lines on the top, leading to, as you can see, the sporadic lateral growth of new branches. It had been trimmed on the right side by the Frankies whenever they needed to. It's not, you will find in the comment to the restatement, this is not a natural condition which the restatement is referring to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Farnsworth. Mr. Anderson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
My head is spinning a little bit about this concept of nuisance. Foolish me. I thought when you define nuisance, you had to define it in terms of negligence or intentional act or absolute liability. I never knew that you can separate them. Here, of course, they want to separate it because you have to separate them out and somehow come up with this theory that first you find whether there's a nuisance and then you can look around, because the nuisance, you see, doesn't involve more than just the tree involved with Frankie's. And that's the reason behind all of this, is that you get to the nuisance first that doesn't involve Frankie's, and then you can start figuring out the duty involved. We ask that you not follow that road. We ask that you follow every case that's talked about nuisance, including Brown, including Plesko, that they rely upon, that says that you have a maintenance of a tree for such length of time by the exercise of ordinary care with regard to that tree. Ordinary care, that's negligence. That's the definition of a branch of nuisance. Secondly, there's some question about what the role of the municipalities are. And I direct the court again to two quotes, one from Coffey and one from Brown. Both in the erection and maintenance of stop signs is a duty owed by the municipality generally to the public. It's a public obligation. Brown said, quote, in removing the menace of a dead tree, the lot owner is not performing any duty imposed upon the public. And here I think it's pretty clear that we've got public duties involved. I mean, there's no question about that. We heard arguments from Dodge County, from the town of Leroy. My goodness, he can't get steeped any more than whether there's a public obligation or not. There's a question about cause, and there's a question about whether or not Frankie's directed verdict should have been entered against them. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, you know, gosh, I'm almost in a trial here. The respondent's asking you to look at the trees, look at the view, listen to the depositions. And our position with regard to the motion for summary judgment and granting that was pretty simple. We think Frankies have a right to have their case heard by a jury, not by affidavit, not by pictures such as what you're looking here. The Court of Appeals agreed with us that, yes, indeed, the cause question is a jury question, which probably brings us down to the heart of this thing, and among all the other, how many angels on the head of a pin do you get to in terms of nuisance?
public policy and common sense to me indicate about the same thing. And so that when we're talking about the fact that, you know, the jury, there's no jury question as to cause, and I understand it was a raise what's being argued. And there's no jury question with regard to negligence, and then I ask, well, what is the duty here? What are the obligations? And for the first time in the state of Wisconsin, the Court of Appeals said, well, the legislature is wrong, and that you don't, the legislature doesn't say where the stop signs are and where the obligation lies. The court says so, and the court's going to say who's ever, anybody around that intersection has anything to do with the stop sign, they can be held liable. That the that's not an obligation of the county, but it's also an obligation of landowners. And the shift that the Court of Appeals did was shift those rights, and who's going to set those rights, from the legislature to Franke's. What the Court of Appeals did said that the legislature that said that those obligations are on the municipality that set the stop signs and on the users of that highway, that that's not right, that it's going to be Franke's obligation. So I joined with Mr. Farnsworth to look at what happened that day, not from the standpoint of whether it's cause, not from the standpoint of whether there's negligence as a matter of law, but from the standpoint of public policy and duty, and whether this court should now shift the obligation of maintaining stop signs on the municipalities, which is clearly said is the case, to Franke's or any other landowner in the state who now has to go out and do, if this Court of Appeals decision upholds, all landowners are going to have to go out and do due diligence about what's on their land and what's blocked, what's not blocked, because believe me, if a tree covering stop sign is going to be a problem, then the cases following that are going to be problems too. And I also ask you if it's good public policy that in this case, which there's no dispute, Diane Smith, coming down the road, doesn't see a stop ahead sign, doesn't see an intersection, doesn't yield the right of way, acknowledges that she's been drinking, acknowledges that she tried to hide 2-3 cans of beer in the culvert after the accident. Whether this is a case in which public policy is not going to shift the obligation of users on the highway to folks like Franke's, I submit that this is not the case to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. That completes our oral argument in 00-1836, Physicians Plus Insurance Corp. versus Midwest Mutual Insurance Company. The court wants to thank all the counsel who appeared and argued.